open the House Committee on Human Services today, February 8th, 2010. I open up a work session on House Bill 3669. And I apologize, apparently it came out on the agenda that we would start at 8 o'clock.
Is that your opinion?
Although we had decided last week that we would start on Mondays only at 8:30, although we may change our mind further on.
I was telling people 9, so.
Don't I wish.
Yeah.
Okay, and we'll just be having work sessions this morning, and I opened up the work session on 3669.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3669 is the repeal of the requirement for disclosure of protected health information that you heard last Friday. No action could be taken on the bill at that point because there was we didn't have all of our fiscal revenue information in. That has come in today. There's a no fiscal, no revenue on that particular bill. So that'll close.
All right. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3669 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Debbie Boone moves House Bill 3669 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the majority of votes required for the passage of this bill, 3669 passes and it goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Does anyone have a particular desire to carry this bill? Representative Freeman, thank you. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 3669. And open up the work session on 3692.
3692 is the traumatic brain injury bill that was heard last week. It does create a 9-member advisory council. It requires DHS to provide staffing for this entity. It, in essence, designates a $5 fee from traffic violations to fund the program. We do have in your packet a revenue statement that was received on this particular bill, but we don't have fiscal information yet, so can't take action on it today. There are just received this morning dash one amendments. I've not had a chance to review them, but there are proponents for this in the audience if you wanted to have them address it.
Yes. Could we hear the proponents of this amendment, please?
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Miette, and I represent the Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority. I manage the section in the Public Health Division in Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology that collects a lot of data on health conditions. One of the things that we've been looking to get established in law in the state of Oregon for about 4 sessions now is the authority to have a traumatic brain injury registry. That registry would do several things. One, it would collect data so that we could better understand the magnitude and scope of the problem of brain injury in Oregon. Right now, we only have data on hospitalizations and deaths that's population-based. If we had a registry One of the things we could do with the data would be to examine those data in terms of injury severity, type of injuries, distribution geographically, according to sex, according to race, and a number of other factors. Those data would help the state in planning for services in terms of what kinds of services are needed, where they're needed, in what amount. The registry data would also provide us information to plan primary prevention around traumatic brain injury. The last point I wanted to make about registry authority and not funding, but we would search for funding through the Centers for Disease Control. On a five-year cycle, they usually provide grants for injury surveillance activities, and TBI surveillance has been one of the priorities for the Centers for Disease Control, Injury Prevention, and Epidemiology section. The five-year cycle will come up again next year. States that have authority to conduct registry activities, of course, have a much higher priority than states that don't. So that's why we continue to ask for authority to establish a registry in the state of Oregon.
And how would you fund this registry?
We would look for federal funding from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention.
So am I correct in assuming then you would not use the amount that has been suggested that we take from fines, traffic fines? Is that correct? You would not take that amount to use for this registry?
Chair Tomain, that's correct.
Thank you. Any further questions of this?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Yeah, just some question. Lisa. So you're wanting to basically create a brand new registry. Is there, have you ever given any consideration to maybe tagging into a current registry and use that? And the reason I'm saying that, Madam Chair, is because, I mean, that's what we did with the database for the medical health through the Oregon State Police LEDS, the law enforcement data system. Rather than create a new system, we actually used that. And I'm just wondering if there's been any consideration toward that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, the registry that we think most closely aligns with the purposes and the type of information we'd be collecting would be the cancer registry. And I have an appointment to talk with the manager of the cancer registry later this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other? Why don't you stay here a minute? And Sherry, could you come up, please? Sherry, have you had a chance to look at this amendment?
No. Chair Tomei, no, I haven't had a chance, sorry. I think Tootie did.
Tootie, do you want to come up? I'm sorry, Sherry, I should have asked you to introduce yourself. Could you do that?
My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon.
Thank you, Sherry.
Hi, I'm Tootie Smith. I represent the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. I read the language that you forwarded to me over this weekend, and the language is quite lengthy and talks in great detail about the registry. We at the Brain Injury Association do support a registry. It will be very important. However, we tried this last session, and language was introduced to do a registry when the ticket was $2. The fiscal impact statement came back. It was so large. All of the money that we were collecting from a $2 ticket basically went to pay for the registry. That's my only concern. I don't know what's really stopping them from going and applying for federal grants. Maybe there's something in the law that I'm not aware of. That could very well be. My concern is over the cost. Have we got the amendments back from LC? And I could not make a determination until I was to read the language from Legislative Council as to their interpretation of what they submitted. If that makes sense.
And we don't have the fiscal on the amendment. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes when amendments or bills are drafted, there's a section in there that says if the money doesn't come forward, then it doesn't happen, or it goes away or whatever. So what I would be concerned about is that Lisa, your amendment wouldn't, you know, say you didn't get it, you got, say we approved the amendment, put it into the bill, and then a grant didn't come forward, and then you usurped all the money that was raised on the tickets, and so that, which is what the concern is from the TBI Association.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, there are actually several data systems that we run that we have absolutely no money to run. And it's really difficult for us to do so. With the traumatic brain injury registry, the grants to establish registries in states that come from the federal governments with no matching costs whatsoever are run on a five-year cycle. They're highly competitive. One of the primary barriers for us being funded, and we've applied 7 times, is the fact that we don't have statutory authority to develop a registry. We're asking for statutory authority with no appropriation. We're asking for just an authority to establish a registry, not funding.
May I follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
The language I received did not mention funding authority whatsoever, so that's why I'm very concerned. If it would have mentioned we are seeking absolutely no funding through this, through state monies, I would have been fine with it, but I think there is some wiggle room in there.
And I asked very deliberately, would any of this money be used for that, and I was told no, but you haven't had a chance to look at the amendment, so we'll not be moving on this today. But I just want to get out as much information as possible.
Thank you very much.
I have a question. The last page, page 5 of the amendment, I'm somewhat confused.
Of the bill or the amendment?
So it refers to section 13, and in line 18, actually, line 13 doesn't have a line 18. I don't know what that means.
I don't have the amendments.
I know. I'm asking.
Oh, I see.
DHSF. So in line 19, it says delete 13 and insert 21, unless there is a new bill here. None of that makes any kind of sense, which is not your fault. But it seems to me we need to clarify that. Would you agree?
Yeah, if you look at the original bill.
Which I've got, right?
Yeah. And that was
section 13.
Yeah, if you look at page 6, I believe these are changing the section numbers. They just forwarded the section numbers on each one of these.
So
yeah, it's just adjusting, Madam Chair.
On line 18, we're adjusting.
This is insert new section numbers because they've inserted several sections.
Oh, I see. Okay, got it. Okay. We'll work that out. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to see us have the registry, and I think we need to do that. If we can tweak this amendment so that it, you know, reflects what Lisa just said, I would support that. Because I really do think we need to have the registry, and I know we can always wait till the next session and all that, but if it's as simple as that, I think we could do that. And I think then it would be acceptable to the association, too.
Mm-hmm. Are we correct in assuming that, Sherry?
Yeah, I mean, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, our concern is, as Tootie was saying, that last time the fiscal came back and it used all but $500 a year would be left over for all services to reach out to people with brain injury, and that wasn't the intent of the bill.
Right.
And
I follow up. I think that, Sherry, I think what I'm saying is that I'm hearing Lisa say that she's her agency is looking at getting a federal grant to pay for this registry, so it wouldn't take any money that's raised by the fees. The license or the ticket fees. That, am I correct? Okay.
Yeah, definitely. If it wasn't coming out of this funding, we definitely support that because we do need a registry.
Yeah, that's
it's
what
really
I was
important.
Okay.
Would it be appropriate to ask the agency to write a memo very specifically saying that there would be no monies taken from the fines that would go into the registry to fund the registry?
Chair Tomei, I think you can request that. I think the intent is on the record, but mm-hmm. if you want to verify
yeah.
the written
I think I'd like to do that. Anybody have a problem with that? Okay, I'd like to do that, please. Any other discussion? Any other questions? Yes.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Why wouldn't we have Lisa amend the amendment to reflect that specifically in the amendment so it's in statute? That
we could, but then that's going to take more time to do that, and then that's got to go to revenue and et cetera, et cetera. I think this would be sufficient. As Rick said, it's already been stated on the record today. If I had it in writing, I would feel pretty comfortable. I would feel very comfortable with that. Any other? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, we will close the work session on 3692, and we will, let's see, I carry it over until Wednesday.
Yes.
Right? And that will be carried over. Okay. We will open up a work session on House Bill 3618.
Chair Tomei and members, this is bill you heard last week. This does modify the home care worker definition for the purpose of providing workers compensation and training to individuals who provide these caretaking services through DHS, Area Agency on Aging, or others. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. You also have in front of you amendments, the dash 2 and dash 3 amendments. And then last week, a series of questions came up that there was insufficient time to answer them at that point. So they were put together by the Department of Human Services. And they are sitting in front of you there. I think there's 5 questions there. And representatives from DHS are here to answer those, as well as a representative from SAFE if there are questions about workers' compensation. Currently, we're waiting on information from BISCO to take action on this bill today, but we don't have it in hand yet.
But we may. Okay, DHS?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. Over the weekend and Friday afternoon, we put together a bunch of information to respond to the 4 or 5 questions that the committee asked last Friday morning. And I'll just go through them real quickly and add a lot of caveats, because some of the data here comes from a lot of different data sources that we had to pull together. But the 5 questions, very briefly, one was, can the department absorb the additional costs that will come through this? The answer is probably not. We, in fact, face some significant deficits in the next biennium or so. So our expectation is that we would seek funding for whatever costs are added over time for this program. The question was asked, what has come via collective bargaining for the existing home care program for aging and people with physical disabilities? That was hard to determine, because we looked at direct care wages, and through the years between 2003, when the first bargaining agreement was signed, and now, there's been cost of living adjustments and other things that have come through the budget, not in collective bargaining, but also we then isolated just the workers' compensation and the health insurance costs, which clearly came through collective bargaining. And at this point in time, for the 07-09 biennium, health insurance and workers' comp for the existing program was about $60.9 million and about $4 million for vacation leave, accrued leave, that came to the collective bargaining process as well. It's very difficult for us to predict how that would translate if we increase the size of the overall home care worker program by about a doubling amount, about 10,000 individuals. So one could say, well, the high estimate could be another $65 million. We don't think it would be anywhere near that high. The payroll for all of the new workers, even though we're doubling the program, is less than half of the program for aging and physical disabilities. The biggest driver there is the developmental disabilities program, where the budget and the dollar amounts are actually capped pretty tightly under the Staley lawsuit agreement. So those people would be working many less hours, therefore as many would not be eligible for health insurance and all that, if in fact they bargained exactly the same benefits that the existing workers have. So we can't give you a precise estimate. It would depend what would come through the collective bargaining process through the years, but that sort of gives the amount for the existing program over that time period. Then on the last page, probably the easiest is there are questions about how many clients, how many workers would be added in this program. And as you know from previous testimony, the expanded definition of the home care program weaves in a lot of different programs and populations and fund sources into a blended whole. And as we broke it down, these are the overall numbers on page 3. About 8,000 plus additional workers serving a little over 10,000 clients in all those different programs. This number, I have to add caveats, because for some of these numbers we have databases. For some of the other numbers, for example, where the payrolls and the workers are all enrolled locally through brokerages or counties or others, our staff actually has been surveying them. So I would have to say those are, we think they're pretty close, but they are, at the end of the day, estimates. But I think it's pretty close in the ballpark. So those were the questions that, to the best of my memory, were asked last Friday.
Thank you, James. Any questions? James, yes, Representative.
Thank you for trying to answer those questions, and I know you spent a lot of time this weekend doing it. So I guess what I'm hearing is, Friday we heard the cost were going to be, not this biennium, but the future biennium, somewhere around $2.5 million a biennium. So today we're hearing it could be up to $65 million, and you said probably not near that amount. So my guess is the range is going to be between $2.5 million and $65 million.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, the only cost calculated in what will be a million or a little under for the duration of this biennium, about $2.5 million for next biennium, is just the phase-in of workers' compensation. The question that was asked here was, what are all the collective bargaining benefits that have accrued to the existing program over time? That's where the $60 million comes from. So, again, it's real hard to say what would roll up in future biennia, depending on what collective bargaining would occur for this additional population. If you said they would get identical benefits, then the range could be as high, although we'd expect it to be lower, because the new groups overall tend to have many fewer hours assigned to clients than the existing program. So that's the difference. The fiscal that we've or the range we've given you to date is only the phase in of workers' compensation, not other health insurance or other benefits.
Just a quick follow-up.
This
bill and this law, if passed, will open that door to occur, though, that we can expect might be 5, 10, 15 years down the road, but there will be some chance of that happening. Whereas if the bill wasn't passed, we wouldn't have that.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, certainly, we'd expect collective bargaining to occur if this group is organized. I mean, first they would have to be organized, but assuming they are, and collective bargaining would occur, and at some point I would think that the groups, since they're all under the Home Care Commission, would obviously try to seek similar benefits. But I'm speculating again.
Thank you.
Let's see. Representative Doherty, I believe. In relation to collective bargaining, the home care workers that you have in this proposal, are these workers that would have to follow the rules under the Employment Relations Board for an election for representation?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe so, yes. That's my belief. I'm not an expert in collective bargaining law, but I believe they would be organized and submitted for an election.
Okay, then I guess I can't have the follow-up questions if you don't know about the collective bargaining. And the question was, is could it be a process of 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road before they would be certified as part of a collective bargaining unit?
Madam Chair, Representative Doherty, I don't think it would take that long. I mean, it would really depend on what the workers and any union attempting to organize them, what their timeframes would be. I don't think it would take a series of 3-4 years, but I just don't know.
It could take that long to get a collective bargaining agreement? Are they organized?
Madam Chair, Representative, again, I'm kind of out of my skill set here. After an election, what we don't know is whether they'd all be elected and certified as part of the existing collective bargaining unit, whether there would be a separate collective bargaining unit for this group. I don't have the answers
lots
to that.
Of questions.
I can certainly pose those kind of questions to the Employment Relations Board and sort of get a range of, but I just don't know.
I would appreciate that, if you could.
Thank you. Yeah, I do. And James, I'm not trying to grill you here, but I guess I think we're all concerned about costs. And what I'm curious about is if this didn't happen and the same clients were, I mean, what would they be looking at for their treatment costs? And I imagine we're talking about them being in some sort of assisted care situation or what, you know what I'm saying? That if we didn't have the home care workers, what would the cost to the state be?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, if we didn't have the home care program at all, the cost would be extraordinary because everyone would have to, if they couldn't absolutely manage at the margins in their own homes and had to be in residential care, the cost would be much higher. For this new and expanded group that we're adding to the Home Care Commission, they're working now. It's not that we're funding a whole new program for a group who otherwise would require residential care. So the additional 10,000 individuals have workers assigned to them. They do provide support, in-home supports, and others. They're simply, they get hourly wages, and they don't get any other benefits, et cetera, that would potentially be added under this bill. But they certainly are providing the work already to people that don't have to be institutionalized because of that.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair. I'm curious, I'm sitting here trying to figure out, how do we end up with this two-tier system?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, we have, again, many different programs for different populations. The aging and physical disability population, beginning well over 10 years ago, developed a home care program where seniors and people with physical disabilities could hire their own workers. Ballot measure 99 in 1999, then in the Constitution, put that group under the Home Care Commission, made them eligible for collective bargaining. And since that time, that program has expanded and it has done very, very well. At different points in time, different programs that traditionally have not been called home care programs and provide services in many cases other than home care have evolved over the years. The Staley lawsuit agreement, which was signed, I think, in 2001, has phased in about 7,000 people with developmental disabilities living in their own home with their families. They get some level of in-home support and support for other community activities. We have personal care programs for mental health populations. We have several waivers for kids that are medically fragile or have severe autism that are served in their own home. So as I've attempted to lay out before, we have about 6 or 7 different programs with 5 or 6 different federal fund sources that all are part, and they have never traditionally been, rightly or wrongly, have never traditionally been considered to be part of the home care program. This bill, with its redefinition of home care, brings those groups and blends them into one overall home care program.
Thank you.
Thank you, James. Representative.
Madam Chair, if you'd be so kind as to just stay with me here, I have a series of questions I would like to ask, just, and they're more kind of probing. The James, Richard, either one of you, it would work out. I'm trying to get a handle on, who put that together? This was the analysis that was directed as a budget note last year for DHS to come back to us.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we, the department, put it together in consultation with Department of Justice.
Okay, thank you. On page 5 of your of this, there in section 11 you're referring to, from my understanding, the Constitution as a result of Measure 99. This is what the report says, and I'll just quote, it's really short. Section 11 prescribes contingency-oriented appointments to the Commission for Seniors and Persons with Physical Disabilities, but no similar appointments for individuals with developmental disabilities or mental illnesses. This suggests that these individuals were not intended to be served by Section 11. So if that's the case, and the Department of Justice has weighed in on it from that perspective, I'm trying to get where are we at with this bill then? I mean, how does that fit? It doesn't seem like it does to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the report, I think we concluded in the report because we were asked to look at three things. One was the Constitution, one was the workers' comp statute, and one was the home care worker statute. And in the two statutes, people with developmental disabilities and mental illness are specifically excluded. In the Constitution, it's vaguer and rather ambiguous because although the commission as it was set up was around the existing home care program at that time that had been developed in the old senior and disabilities division, which did not serve people with mental health needs and with developmental disabilities. And when the commission was formed, it drew from the membership of the stakeholder groups and the old division that served just that population. So with that and with the statutes and with everything else that we analyzed, we said we don't think they're automatically swept in because that was one of the questions from last session. Are they automatically included? And is legislation needed at all? And has the department erred in simply saying these people were not included when they should have been? We didn't think they were automatically included. However, the word disabilities appears throughout. It's not specifically defined in the Constitution, and certainly people with developmental disabilities and depending on your view on mental health is viewed as a disability. Therefore, at the end, we say it is somewhat ambiguous and could certainly be disputed. But so we kind of ended up with a mixed opinion.
Okay. Additional question, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Follow-up?
I want to get back to a question that I asked Representative Denbro and also Mr. Dunda last Friday, and I think you were in here, but it deals with actually on the bill, Section 1, 7B, and again, this deals with who the information would be released to once you've developed, you know, that information. But it says here, shall provide the name and address of a home care worker to an individual who requests the information. I know that the dash threes appear to maybe have addressed that, but then again, when you take a look at the statutes that deal with that for the public record piece of it, it clearly doesn't. I'm curious, so if I'm somebody that just walks in off the street in Department of Human Services and asks for this because it says here clearly anyone, how does that apply to me and where do you sit on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we're always reluctant just to give out lists of names and providers, and we get a lot of requests. Agencies, overall agencies that serve lots of people with different facilities is not so much a problem, but historically, we've been very concerned when we give out foster homes or individual workers. But typically, public records law obligates us if they're paid with public funds, particularly if they're licensed, that we have to release those lists. There have been information requests previously for some of these workers, those that we directly paid by the state or the county, we've said is a public record. Those by brokerages or nonprofits, the public records law does not apply, and that's the biggest number in this group. So some of those names have actually been released before if they worked for somehow through a public payment mechanism and not a nonprofit or a brokerage. But it's always a matter of concern, but typically the public records law obligates us to release almost everything.
Follow up to that, Madam Chair. Okay, staying with the theme of this question and that whole concept, you do not do a background investigation or an inquiry like through a criminal history check law enforcement data system with state police on anybody who comes in. So if I'm somebody who has a criminal record and I come in and I ask for that stuff, from what I've just heard, you mentioned the term that you're reluctant to give, but the law also has the framework that directs you to have to. Do you do any type of a background check on me, who you're releasing that to?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we do not. We obviously do criminal record checks on all the workers themselves, but no, on people requesting the information, no.
And a follow-up with this, Madam Chair. Yes. I would almost venture to say then that you've created yourself some vulnerability with this. Do you not feel that you're vulnerable with this situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, certainly. I mean, if we released information to people who used it for criminal intent or whatever, I would absolutely feel awful. But again, I mean, typically the public records law trumps, and the agency has to release lots of information. What we have found historically, a lot of times the information is released to companies who want to promote their products. So they want the list of all the providers or workers or foster homes or things of that sort. So that's been the typical kinds of requests. And I don't recall an instance where someone abused the information, but that certainly is a possibility. And, of course, that would concern me.
I have additional ones, but go ahead.
Okay, let me get back to you. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow up on the two points that Representative Olson raised. And, you know, first of all, let me say that I appreciate the representative's concern about disclosure and the vulnerability that creates. And, you know, perhaps at some point we as a body should look at our public disclosure laws, but that is not what this bill is about. With all that this bill references is the public disclosure law. If we need to have a broad conversation about what should be and should not be available to the public when it's public records, you know, that warrants a conversation, but that's a big one. And I made some inquiries to see if there have been problems that have devolved, you know, of the nature that Representative Olson has raised. And the people I talked to said that, you know, they have not seen certainly not a widespread or even they couldn't think of any cases in which public information was abused in that way, you know, that led to homes being targeted and break-ins, et cetera. I don't know. And so I'll ask you, James, and perhaps Richard, for the mental health side of things. Do you know, in your experience, have the public record laws been, public disclosure laws, been abused in that way?
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, not to my knowledge. We certainly have gotten complaints of individuals who suddenly heard that their name had been released and wanted to know under what authority we released it, and then we would cite the public records law. But other than making people unhappy periodically, I don't know of an instance where someone with criminal intent or something like that actually use those names.
Follow-up?
Yes. And just, I don't know if you've had to deal with this, but it also was brought to my attention that the public disclosure law does have a kind of opt-out for workers where they can request non-disclosure of their information according to 192.445. I don't know if you've had that experience, but that sort of safety valve opt-out is in place.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, I'm not familiar with that piece of statute.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, thank you. Going to the representative's first point about the findings of, you know, the department, the advice of DOJ. You know, I think that if we go back to the Constitution, I'm obviously very, you know, supportive of the results of that ballot measure, but you know how ballot measures are. They're not necessarily the best crafted legislation. Hence, there is a certain amount of ambiguity in there. I remember that campaign. I remember voting for it. I was supportive of it. I certainly, when I voted for it, was not thinking that I was voting for people with physical disabilities and not voting for people with mental illness. You know, and at that time, I was very aware of the desire to have parity for people in those populations. Obviously, I can't speak for every voter, but I suspect that was the case for most voters. But still, the language was, as Mr. Tave said, to some extent anyway, ambiguous, and that's the purpose of this statute. That's why, you know, once we got that finding, then we saw that this would have to be addressed through a statutory fix, and that's precisely what this bill is all about.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Van Orman.
No, thank you, Chair Tomei.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Thank you guys for putting up with my questions. I'm just trying to get down to this cost thing, and really all the discussion I think makes sense in a lot of ways, but when it gets right down to adding cost to providing services, I get very concerned, especially in these budget situations we're in now. In the Dash 3 amendments, there's some discussion about maintaining service levels. I'm curious to your opinion of how we can statutorily mandate service levels when we can't budgetarily fill those service levels. Any opinion on how that's written?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, my interpretation of the Dash 3 amendments are that they express clear legislative intent that if we add these additional workers and eventually with workers' compensation and other potential collective bargaining costs that will occur, that would hopefully be funded outside of the hours and benefits that the clients currently receive. And that's clear intent, and it's instructions to the Home Care Commission, which is at the bargaining table arguing for different proposals that come forward. But having said that, I don't see that language as binding on the department if the department has to adjust its budget and make reductions because of costs in one area or another. Certainly, we would bring that back to you. We would say, through interest arbitration or something, the following benefits have been added. They're not in our budget. Therefore, we would propose either through a rebalancing or in the next regular session to propose that if no new funding was added, then we would have to adjust the budget somewhere else, which could well end up being reductions in another area. And whether reductions would be in that specific program for those specific clients, I don't know. I mean, again, through the bill, you all will have expressed your intent, but the question will return to you at some point in terms of what the priorities are and how the budget gets balanced. So, I mean, that's just kind of the situation we're in with the budget holes that we see in the future.
Just a quick follow-up on a comment that Representative Dimro made. Thank you, Chair Tomei. There was the word parity used. Could you explain to me how that would play out when this group of people is brought in? I kind of understand it, but maybe just a little bit expansion on what it would cost to pay these workers, what other workers were getting paid type of thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, the parity probably would work out in a couple different ways. I know on the mental health side, those workers providing personal care to mental health clients, actually their wages are lower than people currently in the home care program. On the DD side, in fact, the hourly wages in many cases are higher than the wage paid in the current home care collective bargaining agreement. But that excludes workers' comp, health insurance, and some of those other costs. What we don't know is whether this would be one bargaining unit or a whole new separate bargaining unit. And I'm told even if it's the same bargaining unit, you can bargain different benefits over time for a part of the group. But again, I'm not an expert in that. I would certainly assume people would seek parity and say if we're all now defined as home care workers, then person A should get the same thing as person B. So I would expect those arguments to go forward over time. And I think even in interest arbitration, if the sides don't reach agreement and it goes to interest arbitration, I believe there's even a clause in the interest arb statute that says they look at what other benefits and wages are paid for people doing similar work. So, but again, what the time frame would be, whether it would be in the first round of collective bargaining or subsequent rounds, I just can't answer that at this point.
Thank you. Representative Olson, I think you have a couple more questions.
I do. Thanks, okay. Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
It's just a kind to me today.
I'm always kind to you.
Yes, ma'am. The okay. How does House Bill 2442 play into this? Okay, and let me kind of develop this a little bit. Now, I've heard you testify through the letter that you provided us for information that you're talking somewhere between 8,000 to 9,000 potential of people who are covered under this. Do you have an idea at all, maybe how many, what the percentage might be that might become ineligible due to the fact that they're found to have a criminal record? I mean, that would have a serious impact if it was even as high as 50%. Because we'd have clients out there that would be in a hurt locker. So I'm curious your thoughts on that, and if you have an idea for percentage on that and how it plays out.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, first of all, for all of the new workers that would be added, we run criminal record checks on them now. That's a current requirement. Unlike House Bill 2442 passed last session, though, we do a weighing test. There's no automatic exclusion based on that list of crimes, but it's a weighing test. And in most cases, we think we weed out the bad guys, but there are certain family situations where there might be a criminal record, but the family is well aware of it, was in the distant past, and so we'll look at that situation and say, in this situation, and even will restrict the work to only that particular client or family member. So we've been doing that balancing test for everybody in the program now. House Bill 2442, of course, sets up a list of automatically disqualifying crimes. There is no weighing test. It provides that the disqualifying crimes would only apply going forward. So if you served the same clients, it didn't change clients or jobs, you had been okayed through a weighing test previously, then you wouldn't be automatically disqualified. However, as we interpret the law going forward for new clients, if you have the disqualifying crime on a recheck, you would then be excluded. We don't know exactly what that number could be. It certainly will be higher amongst relatives and family members because that's where the weighing test is used more often. But I can't give you an exact percentage. It certainly will weed out a number of folks, but if that's a high number, I just don't know at this point.
Just a follow-up comment, maybe a question off of that one, Madam Chair. To me, I would think it would be very unfortunate because, let's face it, every one of us have done some things early on in life that we kind of wish we'd never done, you know.
But then, just you, Andrew.
Just not me.
Okay, well, disregard that. It's all on record.
We have that on tape.
Just you.
Back in the old days, we would have said 1243 on that. Disregard. Okay. All right, let's move on. But again, it's unfortunate that the way it's structured right now, there's going to be some folks that are going to get, you know, deleted or removed from this process that have had years of service that have really turned their lives around and are really quality people that are going to get hit as a result of this whole process.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, that's correct.
Okay, Representative, do you have one last question?
Absolutely.
Okay.
These are really short.
Richard hasn't had a chance to speak yet, and I want to make sure that we have.
Well, you know what? Let Richard chip in.
All right. Let's do that. Thank you for coming, Richard.
Richard Harris, Assistant Director of Mental Health Services and Addiction Services, DHS. So is there a question? James is doing a great job.
So now we can ask questions of both of them now legally?
Yes, you may.
Wow.
But we're going to make it short. We do have the fiscals for both amendments. I want to get those out, and
okay,
I would like for us to vote on this today.
As I'm reading the bill, and I just want your opinion on this, it appears that, you know, the bill applies to government and private home care operators. And on the face of that, it does not separate the difference between the two. Is that true? And if that is the case, I mean, where do we go with that? Because it appears to me that at least with private organizations, they would want to have the option to be able to already be out there providing workman's comp.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, it's sort of yes and no. The overarching definition, which pulls everybody in, is that they are hired by the client. So there's an employer-employee relationship between the senior or the person with a disability, mm-hmm. and they're paid with public funds. So in some cases, we for the entire existing program, for example, we have one giant payroll system that pays about 10,000 home care workers. For all these additional programs enumerated here, some are done through counties, through local government. Some are done through nonprofits, which are brokerages. But they all receive public funds as part of this program, and they don't hire and fire the employees directly. They broker the service and the payment and do the fiscal intermediary services, but the employer-employee relationship tracks back to the client. So that's sort of how the two groups get bundled together.
Okay. Thank you.
This is a work session, and it's only invited testimony today, but one person is asked to testify, Doug Riggs, and we will hear that. I've got the fiscals, and after Doug testifies and see if there are any questions, then we will take a break so that you have a chance to look at the fiscals on the two amendments, and then hopefully
we may.
So we have workers' comp coming?
Yeah, we may want to hear from Mike from workers' comp.
Oh, we'll
from
Save.
Mm-hmm. It's not workers' comp.
Yeah. Okay, sorry about. Thank you for reminding me. Is that it?
Yeah.
That's it. Okay, Doug.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We represent about $180 million of services to kids throughout the state. Many of you have been to our facilities, and we appreciate your past support. The cost issue was one that you talked about in detail this morning, and I did want to raise a cost concern that our providers have. This will have a cost impact on my providers. I would say it would have a fairly significant cost impact on my providers, who are already facing serious financial challenges based on the fact that our reimbursement from the state in the mental health side of the equation is at about 60% or less of cost. At some point, the ability to provide quality services diminishes when you get to a certain point. We're at 60% or below right now. So I understand we certainly support providing great benefits and great salaries for our employees. I think if you surveyed our employees in our private sector groups, they would be very happy with their work. They would like to make more money. They'd like to be better compensated. They would like a lot of the elements in this bill. But the reality is that unless the legislature increases reimbursements for these types of programs, we will have, number one, trouble finding and retaining employees, or number two, providing services at the high level that we expect to be able to provide. So I realize that this bill is going to move today, but I do think that financially, for the types of programs we provide, the kids in our services need a reimbursement rate that is much higher than 60% of cost. So, for the record, I wanted to make those comments.
Thank you, Doug. Any quick questions of this?
Well, maybe I'm missing something. Thank you, Madam Chair. But I would think that then this would provide some of that for the workers.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, it certainly would if the Ways and Means Committee sees fit to increase the amount allocated for the budgets of AMH or CAF or OYA. But money is not in the budget to pay for the higher benefits, et cetera. The money has to come out of someplace. So that would be a concern.
Representative Dembro?
Yeah, thank you. Well, your concern is with the overall funding, and so that's probably a concern that needs to be looked at in Ways and Means when we're looking at the funding to effectuate this bill, right? But you don't necessarily have a problem with the program here or having these workers have workers' compensation or training. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Denver, we have no problem with increasing benefits for our employees, and we'd love to do so. If you look at the history of these programs over the last 15 or 20 years, what we've seen is a reduced amount of reimbursement rates for our providers. The only way that we've been able to continue to provide the services that we have has been through private fundraising. So of the $180 million that our agencies spend for 95,000 kids in the state, about $30 million has come from the private sector. So essentially, the private sector fundraising efforts have been subsidizing the state. So if the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature would see fit to increase the amount of money allocated for these programs, then these types of things would be doable. Without that, and given the track record, it's concerning that we may have to absorb additional costs with no additional funding, and that puts many of our providers at the very edge of financial viability, which many of them are already at this point.
So I think it's made. This is a policy committee, not a Ways and Means committee.
I'm sure. I would like to comment if I could.
Sure, but we've got to be quick. And Representative Van Orman is
he answered my question.
Thank you. Very quickly.
Thank you. And I agree that we are a policy committee, and I appreciate your focus on that. The one thing I do want to caution us on is we increase cost through policy. Somebody's got to pay for it, and that's really my concern with the bill. This group of people seems like a great group of people serving a wonderful service to citizens of Oregon, but if we're going to continue to add costs and we can't pay for it, well, we need to be aware of that and make decisions accordingly.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, thank you. And who is coming from SAFE?
Christine.
Okay, thank you. Come on up. Thank you, gentlemen.
Morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation, and with me is Diane Hyland-Edwards from SAFE, who helps to run this program, and she's going to kick me under the table if I say something wrong. But I understood from being here last week that you have some questions about how the workers' compensation cost is computed, and so I thought I'd say a few words about that and then respond to any other questions that the committee might have. We have provided coverage to the existing population of home care workers since April 1 of 2004. And this is a policy that is not like a conventional insurance policy where there is a fixed cost that's established up front. This is very much a partnership between SAFE and DHS and the Home Care Commission, where there is an incentive on the part of DHS to manage the cost of the claims and consequently the ultimate cost of the coverage. It's a program that where we really don't know the final cost until 10 years after the policy period begins. Because we pay the cost of the claims and we only really sort of settle the final cost 10 years later. So a month ago, we sat down with DHS and the Home Care Commission to kind of figure out what is this new population that would come under the program? What are the hazards that they're exposed to and how do they differ from the current population? And based on that, we came up with an estimate of what the workers' compensation cost would be. Now, again, this is really in a state of flux. It's variable. It's contingent upon an accurate estimate of what the payroll would be, because the payroll is really the determinant of the basic premium. We computed a premium rate, and then the biggest variable is obviously the cost of the claims. And what we came up with was what we call our standard premium, which is really, if you took this program and said, if there were a fixed cost, what would the fixed cost be? And we came to a number that is a little under $1.4 million for a year. The maximum would be $2.8 million for 1 year. But the actual amount is going to be heavily dependent on the cost of the claims. And so if the experience is very good, it could be less than that 1.4. If the experience is worse, it can go up to the number that's a little under 2.8 per year, but it can't go more than 2.8. SAFE will bear the cost if it goes beyond that. So that's basically the process that we went through in trying to determine what the potential workers' compensation costs would be, and we provided those estimates to DHS, and they have to sort of make their own pick of where they think those losses are likely to fall.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate coming today. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have several questions.
Okay.
Because I think this, you know, besides the whole money issue, is how you came up with the fiscal. You currently cover, I think, 12,000 people that are similarly situated. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think that's roughly the number.
Okay. So, ma'am, follow up. The major concern I have is that, in fact, these group or these people are not in similar situations, and the major difference is that you don't cover family employer, family employee situations, or I mean circumstances. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think DHS could probably give you a better number there. What I have heard in the last few days is that perhaps out of the current population, around 30% are family members who are providing the service. Under this new population, it may be closer to 60%. So a doubling, if you like, of the percentage of people who are providing the service who are related to the client.
Follow up.
So you do have experience with family and family relationships?
That's correct.
Okay, because that was not my understanding last week, is that you did not have experience with family on family relationship. And the reason that this is important is that you now have employer-employee relationship, and there's the potential for fraud escalates exponentially, because now you'd have someone that's not truly disinterested in the outcome of a workers' comp case. And so if there is intent to defraud, it would be very easy to do so, because they're both parties benefit out of that relationship, and that is a major concern. But if you have that experience, then maybe you can elaborate how you deal with it.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, obviously this is a very different work environment from the traditional thing that you would think about where you're providing workers' compensation. It's an environment that doesn't have the same kind of controls. It doesn't have the same level of loss control that you would apply in a normal work situation. When somebody files a claim, whether that claim is considered to be compensable involves obviously an assessment of whether it falls under the law, but where you have a situation where a party is making a claim and another party is questioning that, it ultimately comes down to the issue of credibility of the person who is making the claim. And so we deal with those situations now with some home care worker situations. There would be more of those, as I understand it, with this larger population.
Madam Chair, but you haven't answered the question. The question is, how are you going to deal with it in this dynamic? You say you have experience. So how do you deal with it today? I mean, there has to be, the scrutiny that's applied in some of these situations has got to be much more significant than, say, a construction worker who falls off a platform when they're at work. I mean, where it's cut and dry, that in fact it was an injury at work. How are you going to deal with it? Because you say SAFE picks up everything over $2.8 million. Well, SAFE, it doesn't just poof, money show up. Someone wrote a check. It's sitting in a reserve, I understand that, but someone wrote a check at some point to cover that. And you do a very good job at minimizing loss, and SAFE should be commended for the work that you do. But my concern is that we continue moving in the right direction and not create some monster that isn't what we intend it to be. That's my concern. the fight, I mean, I've resigned myself to the fact that this bill is going to move, even though we have $192 million revenue forecast that just came out that's going the other way, and now we're adding more to it. But my concern is for your organization and your stability.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I mean, certainly it is more difficult to handle claims in that kind of a situation than in a traditional work environment. And as I said, we really have to just evaluate the statements that are made by the person who is injured and whatever witnesses are available. In this case, maybe you have two family members who are the employer and the employee. Someone actually pointed out to me this morning that the employer may be a 12-year-old child and the employee may be the parent of that child in the way that these relationships are configured. So it's completely different from what our mindsets think about in a traditional workers' compensation environment. And that does make it more difficult. And if there are contested cases, as I said, it really comes down to credibility, but with the absence of independent witnesses, it makes it a little harder to evaluate those claims.
Okay.
Chris,
okay.
There must be other situations where family members employ family members. I can think of all kinds, but certainly construction, the Schnitzer Steel people were here at another committee last week, and certainly members of their family are hired by those folks, all kinds of industry across the state. So does that come up as an issue in those industries, aside from the jobs we're talking about here?
Madam Chair, I think that's less of an issue when you're dealing with a large corporation where you have an established fabric within the company of how you deal with workers' compensation, human resource issues, and so on. What we're talking about here is something that is happening within the family home, which brings in all kinds of different dynamics.
I understand that, but I guess I can imagine, say, in a small construction firm where the father hires his son and there is a claim. So how do you deal with that? Do you see a lot of fraud in those situations?
Madam Chair, I can't say that we see a lot of fraud in those situations, but there are certainly sometimes claims that come up that appear questionable. And as I've said, we have to go through this process of collecting information and trying to determine who is credible.
Thank you.
Just one comment about that.
Before you do that, let me just ask. It's 20 to 10, and floor session, I think, is at 10:45. Does anyone have anything that they need to do between 10 and 10:45 that they can't be here in committee?
We have caucus at 10:30.
At 10:30, okay. We will be sure and be out by 10:30. Anything else? Great. Okay.
quickly, and the concern I have is the construction is a good analogy because, in fact, those family relations have happened quite a bit. But you know, when you service a family member in your home and you do laundry, which is one of your work tasks, is it laundry for the client or is it your laundry that you wrenched your back on lifting the laundry basket up? Those are the questions that I have. And he answered it. It comes down to credibility. And, you know, I'm not disparaging that population of workers at all. But you're just creating, I mean, you're creating a situation that I think you're going to have to be very cognizant. And I think you're aware of that, that this could be an issue that you need to and probably deal with a little bit more. This is not about if it's an injury on the work, then fine. But you know, it's like everything. Someone's writing a check someplace, and those resources are not unlimited. So.
Representative Freeman, I know you want to speak, but Representative Denborough asked some time ago.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just following on that, I want to remind Rep. Maurer that in the current population, nearly a third of the workers are family members. In some cases, close family, in others, more distant family. And, you know, SAFE has been developing ways of dealing with that situation. So it's not as if we're opening the door to a new population. And, you know, I think so far SAFE has had a pretty good track record on this. One of the reasons, this kind of segues into my question, One of the ways that SAFE has partnered effectively, I think, with the Home Care Commission and DHS to keep costs relatively down is through training. Right? I remember last year in the House Health Care Committee, we had a hearing, and you might remember this, Ron, on the importance of training for people working with clients in long-term care or in assisted living facilities, et cetera. And just the critical nature of training as a way to prevent injury and to prevent injury ultimately both to the worker and to the client. And I wonder if you could say something about how SAFE partners with the agencies over training or encourages training, something about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Denbrough, obviously loss control is very important to us. It's a lot better that nobody gets hurt if we can ever manage that. And so we work with employers to provide loss control training programs, and we have worked with the Home Care Commission on how to do that. I don't have specific details of the services that we have provided, but that is a standard service and an interest that we have in trying to make sure that people don't get injured.
Representative Daughtry and Representative Freeman, did you have a question?
No, it's been answered. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Thank you guys for putting up with these questions. The relationship between employee and employer that you described as a 12-year-old hiring a parent as an employer-employee relationship, how does that work if we take it one step forward or further in saying that the 12-year-old has a mental disability? How can that relationship work as it pertains to workman's comp, providing a safe work condition or really any sort of meaningful information back to you if there's a claim? Do you simply just ask the employee what the injury is? I mean, how does that work?
Representative Freeman, I think that's uncharted territory because I don't think we have that situation with the current population, but we would be potentially moving into that with the new population, and obviously that presents significant challenges. I can't really give you a specific answer to that today, but it clearly would be something new.
And then just a quick follow-up. I'm sure.
Go ahead.
The current group of people are covered. The group we're talking about bringing in, for lack of a better term, are they kind of like independent contractors now that are paid a wage, and out of that wage they can buy insurance or whatever they want for themselves out of that? Is that kind of how it works?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, again, DHS would probably be able to give you a better response to that. My understanding is that a lot of these people are provided through independent agencies. And under the workers' compensation law, somebody who provides domestic service is not required to be covered for workers' compensation. So this population, although they could elect to have coverage, my understanding is that this population has not had coverage elected for them in the past.
Okay. And then my last one, and I know we're trying to get through this. You talked a little bit about traditional type of employee-employee relationships, and there was even some discussion of family members within that traditional style. I know, having provided workman's comp to my employees for the last over 18 years, one of my incentives for making sure it's a safe workplace and that I train properly is my rate. I get a better rate if I don't have a whole bunch of claims. Matter of fact, I had my first claim ever last year, and I was pretty upset about it. That being said, since to us the rate structure is an incentive, how is it you're going to have an incentive for these employers when their rate isn't affected? I mean, it doesn't affect them at all, the number of claims. And I know you already do that with the current population. I'm just curious how you give an incentive for people not to abuse the system.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, that's a good point. And as we've talked about other kinds of construction companies, for example, the person who is the employer is actually paying the premium, and so there is an incentive for them to manage their costs there. This, again, is a totally unique situation where the employer is the person who is the client, but they are, if you like, transferring that employment relationship to DHS or to the Home Care Commission. And it's certainly true that there is no financial incentive for that client to manage the claims in the way that there would be in a traditional workers' compensation environment. That's true.
Thank you.
One last question, Representative Maurer.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Okay, I don't know if I was how clear, how much more clear I need to be. The question is, you just said uncharted territory in a 12-year-old employer relationship with the mother as employee. You haven't done that yet. And now, I mean, so you either have done it or you haven't done it. And you say you haven't done it. And if you haven't done it, how are you going to deal with it? That's the question. I mean, is that clear? Am I not clear?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, he's a little bit mistaken here. Children are not employers, because what the bill does, and in fact, that was a question even when we presented the paper on whether all these workers were currently in the work we did with the AG. A child by law cannot be an employer. What the bill does is it says anybody hired by the client or the client's parent or legal guardian. So in that sense now, the employer-employee relationship would shift to the parent, not to the child. So I don't envision anything in here that's actually going to have children as employers. Right. Okay. It's still all in the family home, but it's not technically an employer-employee relationship.
That the same individual is the employer-employee? Mom's the employer and mom's the employee?
Madam Chair, isn't it true, James, that with the current population, there are third parties that act as the employer of record, as it were. That's my understanding.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrow, not exactly. For the current program, all the clients live in their own homes or their own apartments. We send home care workers into those homes to provide care, many of whom happen, or a percentage happen to be relatives. In some cases, though, we have a live-in provider, but the live-in provider who is a relative still is in the home of the client who is the senior or the person with a disability. Under the whole Staley agreement, particularly for the DD population, we provide a lot of in-home supports where family members themselves are compensated to provide part of that care, part in the home and in some cases outside of the home. In some cases it's not family members, but it's other people. But the difference there is the person is living in the home, typically with family members, and that's the twist here. I don't think we have an employer-employee relationship within one person. I don't think we could legally do that. But I'm not sure with the children now. I know for a fact that a child cannot be an employer.
If I could just follow up, based on conversations I believe I had with the Home Care Commission, there are some clients who prefer not to be involved in the employer-employee relationship, and someone else takes their place in doing that kind of work. And I would think that presumably, under this new situation, you would have something comparable.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrow, we have a percentage of clients who purchase their care from an in-home agency, in which case there isn't an employer-employee relationship, but it's a worker that's actually hired to the in-home agency, in which case the wages, benefits, workers' comp is all handled through that agency.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, James, you just, I think you kind of crystallized maybe what Doug was saying a little bit ago. So, if we pass this bill, regardless of what fiscal we're talking about here, we might actually be mandating or forcing these third-party employer relationships. We're forcing the cost on them. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I don't think anything shifts cost to third party. This bill deals with employees that are hired by the client or the client's family or legal guardian, not by an agency that would send in workers that are actually employees of that agency. In the bigger picture, he's absolutely right. If this program costs a lot and we don't have more money and we have to cut something else, then a lot of our different programs could be affected. But I don't see anything passing a cost directly on to other agencies besides client-employed providers.
Are you okay?
No, I still have one.
Okay, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. One of the key components of this whole thing, though, is education, training. In having myself paid workers' comp over the years, I don't like claims either. And so training was a critical part of prevention. And so my understanding of this bill was to also provide access to training as well as the rest. But training was, to me, to prevent workers' comp claims, training is critical. And when you're working with populations such as we're talking about, training is critical.
We're going
to... I'm sorry.
I've got Representative Olson first, and then we'll see.
You know what? I'll pass.
Okay. I'll pass. Representative Freeman, really fast.
Really quick. I just wanted to follow up on my question about the employer agreement, and we used a 12-year-old mental disabled child. Let's take that up to an 18 or an adult disabled child hiring a parent. And I mean, it's the same question. Do we have that? We're going to have that situation now where we didn't have it before?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, yes, probably.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think we've beaten this horse until it's very, very dead.
Diane didn't say that. I mean, that's not right.
Thank you, Diane. You like it best that way. Okay. Thank you. I think we've heard all the testimony that we had asked for today. So we have two amendments, and we have the fiscal analyses for these. So what I'd like to do is pass these out, take a five-minute break. Does 5 minutes do it for you guys? And do not do a forum discussion.
That's not hard for us.
Some of us don't have to worry about that.
So I'm going to take a five-minute break, so I expect you to be back. Simpson, House Committee on Human Services. And so, Representative Boone.
Chair Tomei, I move to adopt the dash three amendments.
Boone, or Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the dash three amendments. Any discussion?
Well, Madam Chair,
yes.
Dash threes doesn't get it to what we've already had the discussion on for creating good policy and the portion of it for protecting the people there. I mean, very easily. I mean, what is this all about? I mean, it's to provide an avenue for a collective bargaining unit issue to occur. But again, like what I had described earlier, I'm fearful for those folks that are going to have their name out there that anybody can have access to. The dash twos eliminates that piece. That would be my only opposition to the dash threes.
Well noted, and I'm wondering if that isn't something that could be dealt with, because there are lots of lists out there, maybe in the Judiciary Committee, that might be a better avenue to address that. Because it's not just this one registry.
Well, but we're working, I understand that, what you're saying, Madam Chair, but the point being is that we are working on policy right now, and let's face it, policy does drive fiscal, and if we don't put forward good policy from our view here, then, I mean, we have the consequences we pay for. So that's another day and another dollar for what you're describing for the public records issue.
Okay, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And my problem with the dash three amendments is that we somehow are thinking we're putting into statute a dedicated funding or a funding level into the future, when in fact we've heard we're not able to do that. And I think it's disingenuous to try to put that in statute knowing that we don't have the authority to do that. So I'm not going to vote for the amendments.
Okay, thank you, Representative Freeman. Any other discussions? Okay, Debbie, would you call the vote, please?
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having passed the required majority, the dash three is amended to House Bill 3618.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3618 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill would be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 3618 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Sorry. Aye.
And Vice Chair Olson?
No.
And Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Committee, you have been terrific. I know you've got lots of issues that haven't been dealt with, some of you, and I think you've been very polite and respectful in your questions and your concerns, and I respect that. Representative Olson.
Yeah, just Madam Chair, just want to give you a notice that there's potential for a minority report.
No, it's not this time.
Pardon me?
We can't.
We got to wait?
Because it's going to be ways and means.
Okay, we'll wait then. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Thank you very much. We have a short meeting on Wednesday, and so we will be having an informational hearing on the children and families, and is that right? Update on child welfare and critical incident response team.
Madam Chair, what time will we begin Wednesday? Will we have a full two-hour agenda?
Do you want to meet later? Do you want to meet at 8:30? You want to meet at 8?
8 o'clock's fine.
8:30 is fine.
If it's short.
It's the length of the meeting as opposed to the start time. That's
right. Well, I can imagine that it might take an hour and a half at most.
Most,
yeah. So shall we meet at 8:30?
That'd be great.
Okay.
8:30?
8:30 it is. All right. With that, I close the House Committee on Human Services.